Omaha Public Radio presents another program from the E.N. Thompson Forum on World Issues on Noon Forum. The E.N. Thompson Forum is co-sponsored by the Cooper Foundation, the LEAD Center, and the University of Nebraska at Lincoln. Today we'll hear the forum's annual Chuck and Linda Wilson dialogue. The guest speakers will be Andrew Basevich, professor of international relations and history at Boston University, and author of Breach of Trust, How Americans Failed Their Soldiers and Their Country, and Derek Chollet, Assistant Secretary of Defense for International Security Affairs and Principal Advisor to the Undersecretary of Defense and Secretary of Defense on International Security Strategy and Policy Issues related to Europe, the Middle East, and Africa. They will address the topic, The American Military, War and Peace, Spending and Politics. This program was recorded by Omaha Public Radio on Tuesday evening, February 11, 2014, for broadcast at this time. The opinions expressed are those of the speakers and do not necessarily represent those of the sponsors of the E.N. Thompson Forum, KIOS-FM, or the Omaha Public School District. Here now to introduce the program is Tim Borstelman, E.N. and Catherine Thompson Professor of Modern World History at the University of Nebraska at Lincoln.
Tonight, we have the honor of hearing from two of the world's leading experts on the current state of the United States military. Our first speaker, Derek Chollet, is a Lincoln native, a graduate of Lincoln Southeast High School and Cornell University, and a former special assistant to the president and senior director for strategic planning on the National Security Council staff. He is currently the Assistant Secretary of Defense for International Security Affairs, a position in which he serves as a principal advisor to Secretary of Defense Chuck Hagel on international security strategy and policy issues. One smiles to think of so much level-headed Nebraskan influence on the Pentagon. Assistant Secretary Chollet is also the author and co-author of several books on U.S. foreign relations. Our second speaker this evening is Andrew Basevich, a professor of international relations and history at Boston University. Professor Basevich served in the U.S. Army during the Vietnam War, as well as in Germany and in the Persian Gulf before retiring as a colonel in the early 1990s. He is a graduate of the U.S. Military Academy at West Point and holds a PhD in history from Princeton University. He has published several widely read books on American foreign policy and military history, the most recent of which is entitled Breach of Trust, How Americans Failed Their Soldiers and Their Country. Professor Basevich has developed a well-deserved reputation as one of the most clear-eyed critics of American politics and U.S. foreign policy. Let me just announce finally, before we get going here, that books by both Professor Basevich and Assistant Secretary Chollet will be available for sale in the lobby following this dialogue. So please join me now in welcoming Andrew Basevich and Derek Chollet.
Thank you. Thank you. It is truly my honor to be with all of you tonight. It's great to be home in Lincoln with so many family and friends here. And although I've lived in Washington, D.C. for a better part of 20 years, I remain a proud Nebraskan. And I have the privilege of working with another proud Nebraskan, our state's former senator, and now our country's terrific Secretary of Defense, Chuck Hagel. During the past year, I've traveled the world with Secretary Hagel, to the Middle East, to Europe, to Asia, and I've watched him tackle so many tough issues, from Syria and Iran to the defense budget. And while I'm certainly a little biased, I can tell you that the American people are fortunate to have a Nebraskan as Secretary of Defense. It's very special for me to be on the UNL campus, a place where I spent pretty much every fall Saturday of my childhood growing up in Memorial Stadium. I'm also very proud to be here as part of the Thompson Forum, and I thank the Wilson family for their generosity in putting this dialogue together, and I thank the Thompson family. It's very special for me to be here in an event named after a family that I've considered friends since the early 1980s. I also feel privileged to share the stage with Professor Borstelman. I'm sure Tim doesn't remember this, but I first met him in the early 1990s when I was at Cornell and he was a young faculty member, and I recall attending an evening seminar with him in a dingy Cornell student lounge on American foreign policy, and so I'm very, very glad to be back sharing the stage with him now. for yet another talk on American foreign policy, and I'm glad we're doing it in a place that looks and feels a little different than the Cornell Student Lounge. And finally, I'm deeply honored to be here with Professor Bacevich, Andrew Bacevich, who's one of the brightest and most compelling thinkers on military affairs and American foreign policy we have. Andy is someone who you don't always have to agree with, but you will always learn from. I recall being in a meeting with Secretary Hagel and the chairman of our Joint Chiefs of Staff, General Marty Dempsey, and the chairman brought up an op-ed that was in that day's news clips that Professor Bacevich had written. I can't recall the subject of the op-ed, but I'm pretty sure it was criticizing our policy, and I'm pretty sure it stung. But I remember that both the chairman and the secretary remarking that they knew you and that they admired you and that they both agreed that you're a very smart guy. So I can assure all of you that Andrew Bacevich is someone taken very seriously at the highest levels of our government, and I look forward to learning from him tonight. It's very good for me to be out of the Washington, D.C. bubble for a couple days. President Obama's first Secretary of Defense, Robert Gates, who was a proud Kansan, always made it a habit to get out of Washington every now and then and speak to audiences like this. Secretary Gates kept a healthy Midwestern perspective on our nation's capital, and it's a perspective that I have always tried to remember and keep in mind as I go about my work. He used to observe that Washington is a city where those who travel the high road of humility encounter very little traffic, where people often say, "I will double cross that bridge when I come to it," and where you can see many prominent people walking down the street, walking down Lover's Lane, holding their own hands. So keeping those important insights in mind, I'll use my opening comments to focus on three areas that have defined U.S. defense policy during the past 5 years. First, winding down the wars in Iraq and Afghanistan. Second, adjusting defense spending to new budget constraints while ensuring that we have a defense strategy that serves our national security interests. And third, recalibrating the role of military power in America's foreign policy alongside diplomacy and development. I'll start with the highest national security priority President Obama faced when he came into office, dealing with the wars in Iraq and Afghanistan. In February 2009, the United States had been at war for the better part of a decade, which soon became the longest period of war in our nation's history. There were 180,000 American men and women serving in Iraq and Afghanistan, including from the Nebraska National Guard, and few commentators or common citizens believed at the time that either conflict was going particularly well. Now, as we all remember, the Iraq War had been a bitter issue for our country and had been the central question of the 2008 presidential campaign. Then-candidate Obama promised to execute a responsible withdrawal of U.S. forces from Iraq, and in his first major speech as president in March 2009, he announced a new strategy to end the combat mission by removing all troops by the end of 2011. In Afghanistan, the president wanted to regain the upper hand. So he surged military forces while simultaneously narrowing the mission to a tight focus on disrupting, dismantling, and defeating al-Qaeda. The fight in Afghanistan has been very tough. Over 3,400 lives have been lost from the United States and our partner nations in Afghanistan, including 14 Nebraskans. But the tide of war is receding. In Iraq, all U.S. forces left at the end of 2011. And now we are developing what we at the Pentagon call a normal defense relationship with the Iraqis. It's very difficult, but we are helping the Iraqis with advice and equipment needs. And in Afghanistan, nearly 60,000 U.S. troops have come home, and the 34,000 that remain today will withdraw by the end of the year. Now, if the Afghan government is willing, the United States and many of our global partners could maintain a small presence in Afghanistan to help train, advise, and assist the Afghan forces and to help with counterterrorism. The costs of the wars in Iraq and Afghanistan have been profound in both blood and treasure. Nearly 7,000 Americans have paid the ultimate sacrifice, and tens of thousands carry the physical and psychological wounds of war. But the financial costs have been profound as well. Some estimate that in the end, these wars will have cost nearly $6 trillion of taxpayer money, and disability and medical costs will continue for decades. Now, to be sure, many of these financial costs were necessary to get the equipment and needs to the warfighter. But during the decade after 9/11, the defense budget ballooned to unsustainable levels, particularly after the financial crisis struck in 2008 and our nation's deficits grew so rapidly. That's why the Obama administration has set out to reform defense spending. For the last 5 years, Pentagon leaders have had to do what every family does when money gets tight. They've set priorities, they've cut spending on things that are lower priorities or aren't truly needed. This process began under Secretary of Defense Gates in 2009, when he set out to cut or curtail more than 30 major military modernization programs that were growing too costly, taking too long to develop, or were poorly suited to current needs. If these systems had been pursued to completion, they would have cost the taxpayers more than $300 million. Secretary Gates also began cutting the Pentagon's bloated budget in order to direct more money to real military capabilities. These defense reform efforts continued under President Obama's second Secretary of Defense, Leon Panetta, and continue today under Secretary Hagel. Now, Secretary Panetta, several years ago, was only a month into the job in August 2011 when Congress enacted a law that required the Pentagon to cut $487 billion, now that's billion with a B, from its budget over the next decade. And last year, on Secretary Hagel's second day at the Pentagon, an additional round of steep, abrupt cuts were implemented under this crazy legislative mechanism that we call sequester. Now, sequester is a phrase that only folks in Washington can come up with, but what it meant was that a new round of cuts of about $50 billion over 10 years had to be made without any discretion or ability to change them. And so although this bipartisan budget agreement that was passed by our Congress last December gives DOD some relief from sequestration, Secretary Hagel still has to implement a total of $70 billion in additional cuts during the next 2 years. So all three Secretaries of Defense under President Obama have implemented spending cuts over the last 5 years, have recognized a central fact that this is not just a math exercise, that the U.S. still has global interests and responsibilities, and other nations are modernizing their militaries and challenging our traditional technological superiority in spheres like air, sea, cyber, and even space. So we have worked hard to align our defense strategy with this new fiscal reality. Fundamentally, strategy is about choices, and having to do with less helps clarify priorities and trade-offs. With this in mind, during the past several years, the administration has undertaken several major strategic reviews to align our strategy with our budget and our national highest security priorities. Now, these efforts are driven all toward the same goal, to define a defense policy that protects our national security interests with sustainable resources. Next month, the President will submit to the Congress a new budget which will include a 5-year defense spending plan. And this will be the first defense spending plan after the 13 years of post-9/11 conflict. Now, while I can't share any particulars of that budget with you tonight, I would expect that this will reflect six strategic priorities that Secretary Hagel first outlined in a speech that he gave in Washington last fall. First, the Pentagon will continue to focus on institutional reform. Secretary Hagel has already announced a 20% reduction in the department's major headquarters, beginning in his own office, the Office of the Secretary of Defense. Second, as we come out of more than a decade of war, the military will reassess the assumptions and scenarios for which it organizes, trains, and equips, recognizing that the advances made by global rivals and potential adversaries. Third, the military will focus on addressing the readiness challenges caused by sequestration in order to avoid a hollow force like we had after Vietnam, a force that lacks sufficient training and equipment to accomplish its assigned missions. Fourth, the military will protect investments in emerging military capabilities, especially space, cyber, special operations, and intelligence, surveillance, and reconnaissance. Fifth, Secretary Hagel has made very clear that he wants the military to stay in balance even as resources come down, to have the right mix of forces in the right places around the world to accomplish the most important and most likely missions of the future. And sixth, Secretary Hagel has said that we will have to achieve savings in military compensation, which has grown 40% above the private sector since 2011, in order to adequately fund training and modernization. Otherwise, we risk becoming a force that is well compensated but poorly trained and equipped. In President Obama's State of the Union address just last month, he made clear that America must move off a permanent war footing. A key part of that is putting the budget and the strategy on a sustainable course. But it also means recalibrating the role of military power and the use of force in America's national security policy by elevating the role of diplomacy and development and by being very judicious about the use of force. Make no mistake, the world remains a very dangerous place, and at times, military force will be necessary to protect our interests. During the past 5 years, we have taken the fight to Al-Qaeda and terrorist networks. We have decimated Al-Qaeda's top leadership, including Osama bin Laden. Now, this doesn't mean that using military force is always the best way to achieve our goals, nor should the use of force be unlimited. Consider two examples from the recent past, Libya and Syria. In Libya 3 years ago, as Gaddafi's forces threatened the opposition, potentially wiping out hundreds of thousands of civilians, the United States and our key allies intervened. But rather than invade Libya with hundreds of thousands of troops like we did in Iraq, the U.S. and our partners used air power to stop Gaddafi, leading to his overthrow. From the time President Obama decided to intervene, he made very clear that the role the U.S. should play must be limited to its unique capabilities, such as intelligence, airlift, refueling, and precision munitions, and that we needed to work to get other countries to step up, which they did. It's true, the United States provided the bulk of the military muscle in the beginning, but the operation demonstrated the value for our allies to maintain highly capable militaries that plan, train, and equip together. Now, it might be surprising to some, but overall, U.S. forces flew just more than 10% of the strike missions in Libya, while the U.K. and France flew nearly half. Simply put, Libya was not America's fight alone, and it showed that leading is not always about charging ahead, but it is often about enabling collective action. And then last summer, in Syria, the Assad regime used chemical weapons to kill over 1,300 innocent civilians outside Damascus. After these horrific attacks, the president ordered the Pentagon to develop plans to use force to punish Assad, conducting airstrikes that would degrade and deter his military's capability and willingness to conduct further chemical weapons attacks. Now, as we prepared for military action, positioning ships and planes into position to strike, the president made the bold decision to seek congressional authorization for the use of force. He believed that while, as a constitutional matter, presidents reserve the right to use the military on their own, the country is always stronger if we are unified and use force with the support of the Congress, and through the Congress, the American people. Now, I was one of the officials assigned to make the case to the Congress for the use of force resolution. So I spent the better part of 2 weeks on Capitol Hill meeting with members of the House and the Senate and their staffs. I can attest to you that the system worked. The Congress took its job very seriously, gathering information, asking thoughtful questions, and challenging our assumptions. But in the end, congressional authorization for military action proved unnecessary. Our credible threat of force compelled Assad to back down, giving a chance for diplomacy to step in. To prevent an attack, Assad agreed to a UN Security Council resolution that forced him to give up his chemical weapons. So today, remarkably, we are on the cusp of achieving something very significant: Syria voluntarily giving up its chemical weapons to be destroyed without a shot being fired. Now, there's still a way to go, and Syria still needs to live up to its obligations. But a Syria without chemical weapons makes us all safer. And I should add as an aside, the destruction process itself to destroy the chemical weapons still requires a unique United States capability, a Navy ship with the system to destroy the chemical weapons at sea. So in Libya, we saw the United States does not have to go it alone. In fact, we're more effective when we focus on using our unique military capabilities and working with others. And in Syria, we saw that military power can be a critical part of diplomacy, and that the true test of influence is when you can compel action without force being used. So in conclusion, I'll leave you with this. We are coming out of the longest period of war in American history. And thinking ahead, it is important to remember that our military, although unparalleled in capability, should be one of many instruments of our power. Our defense should be agile, flexible, ready, and technologically advanced, all within the limits of reasonable cost. The United States needs to ensure that all instruments of our power, diplomatic, economic, development, our values, and defense, work together to serve our interests and help solve problems. This is what Secretary of State Hillary Clinton, my first boss in the administration, called using smart power. And this is something that my current boss, Secretary of Defense Hagel, believes in deeply. As President Obama said in his State of the Union address a few weeks ago, we must remember that our leadership is defined not just by our defense against threats, but by the enormous opportunities to do good and promote understanding around the globe, to forge greater cooperation, to expand new markets, to free people from fear and from want. and no one is better positioned to take advantage of those opportunities than America. Thank you very much for your time. I look forward to the discussion and your questions. Over to Professor Bacevich.
I wonder if I could begin with a complaint. I've never visited Lincoln before today. I've been to Nebraska, I think, once in my entire life before today. And I really don't think it's quite fair that I should be pitted against the hometown hero. Now, I could tell you stories about my Hoosier roots. I'm just not sure it would have the same impact. So I understand my charter to be to reflect on three very specific questions or issues related to basic U.S. national security policy. Two of these questions are sort of recent vintage. One is quite a bit older. So the three things that I'm ultimately going to circle around to talk about. First, what are the implications of relying on what we call the all-volunteer force? More accurately, a professional military. Second, the whole question of whether maintaining a global military presence with U.S. forces, U.S. bases scattered in dozens of countries around the world, whether that notion still is justified long after the end of the Cold War, which was the event that created this notion in the first place. And third, and this is the old question, what role, if any, does the military-industrial complex play in influencing U.S. national security policy? Before I get to those, I'd like to offer a couple of preliminary reflections, sort of frame my answers to the narrow questions. And I have to say that I sit there listening to Secretary Hagel's list of six priorities, which, of course, are President Obama's defense or national security priorities, and there is nothing about them that I would object to. I'd endorse them. A little bit disturbed, I think the cuts in Secretary Hagel's office are going to occur over, like, 5 years. But nonetheless, a downsizing of headquarters is probably a good idea. My problem, and that I hope it'll come out in my remarks, is I do think that these proposed reforms constitute a recalibration, an adjustment, whereas my position would be big change is needed. At least big change ought to be considered. So, preliminary thoughts, point number one. Power confers choice. At least it ought to. And as the most powerful nation in the world, blessed with an astonishingly favorable geopolitical situation, the United States enjoys, or ought to enjoy, considerable freedom of action in deciding how we are going to relate to the rest of the world. And I'd say one of the great failures of policymakers since the end of the Cold War, this is not directed in particular at any administration, but one of the great failures of U.S. policy since the end of the Cold War is the failure to recognize that we do have choices available and that we can exercise choices to go in a different direction. Instead, policymakers, claiming that we are the indispensable nation, you've heard that phrase, they have insisted that there really is no alternative but to exercise global leadership. Again, a phrase that you're familiar with. And so in this framework of seeing ourselves as indispensable, of being called upon to exercise global leadership for all practical purposes, we press on. Washington presses on, following a particular azimuth, to my mind, insufficiently sensitive to the costs and consequences along the way. Second larger point. How are we to evaluate the exercise of global leadership? Well, I don't want to disregard moral considerations, because they ought to figure in any conversation we have about policy. But that said, it seems to me that the primary basis for evaluating policy must be a pragmatic one. Does policy work? Does it provide a good return on the blood and the treasure expended pursuant to policy objectives? For the whole post-Cold War era, we're talking about more than three decades now, the big question that we need to confront as citizens: are the exertions of our national security establishment making us more secure and more prosperous? If the answer is yes, if we are becoming more secure and more prosperous, then we owe a debt of gratitude to our post-Cold War presidents, both Presidents Bush, President Clinton, and President Obama. And we should press on the course that we are following. If the answer is no, however, then it seems to me it's time for us to rethink basic policy and to try to exercise the choices that should be available to a powerful nation. And I have to tell you that my answer to the question is manifestly no. Our policies are not making us more secure, and they are not making us more prosperous, and they are costing us a lot. Now, unfortunately, I say this as an outside observer, it seems to me that our national security establishment is so invested in a status quo carried over from the Cold War, that our leaders lack the creative capacity to produce or evaluate alternative approaches, and so we blunder on. Here's the essence of post-Cold War U.S. national security policy expressed in one single sentence. People in Washington believe that through the adroit use of military power, the United States can shape the international order to maintain U.S. global primacy. That's why today, despite the budget cuts that we just heard about, that's why today the Pentagon budget is larger in constant dollars than it was at any time during the Cold War. Remember the Cold War? Bipolar order, two superpowers, World War III on the horizon. There ain't no other superpower today. But we're spending more today in constant dollars than we ever did in the 50s and the 60s and the 70s and the 80s. That's why the Department of Defense, that's why U.S. forces are constantly prowling around the world. I don't know if it was the op-ed, but I recently wrote an op-ed that quite frankly, was mocking a U.S. Army initiative called Pacific Pathways. You know, now that we've pulled out of Iraq and we're pulling out of Afghanistan, I'll state this very crudely. It's my own service. Out of Iraq, out of Afghanistan, the Army's looking for a reason to justify its existence. If you don't justify your existence, you can't justify your budgetary claim. If you don't justify your budgetary claim, then your status, standing, influence in the realm of national security declines. So Pacific Pathways is an Army proposal to sort of have separate brigades wandering around friendly countries in the Pacific available to help. It's why the Defense Department devotes the vast majority of its efforts not to defending the United States of America, but to projecting military power hither and yon. Remember, after 9/11, whatever else you want to say about 9/11, it was a catastrophic failure of the national security establishment to perform its most essential functions. And what was the response to that failure? Create a new cabinet agency that has the job of defending America, called the Department of Homeland Security, so that the Department of Defense, which doesn't particularly focus on defense, could continue to project power around the world. So again, the core question is, Is it working? Practically speaking. Well, let's examine the results achieved since the end of the Cold War in the greater Middle East, which has been the focal point of U.S. military activity for nearly a quarter of a century now. Are U.S. efforts making the Islamic world more stable? Are the people living in these quarters, Iraqis, Afghans, Pakistanis, Saudis, and so on, are these people becoming more favorably disposed toward the United States of America? The answers to these questions are no and no. Are wars in this region, large ones like Iraq and Afghanistan, but also smaller engagements in places like Somalia, Yemen, and Libya, will ultimately cost us, you already heard this, trillions of dollars. Not billions with a B, trillions with a T. What are we getting in return? Not much, in my view. Yet political and military elites seem remarkably reticent when confronting the yawning gap between expectations and outcomes. To do so, to confront that yawning gap between expectations and outcome, would call into question the fundamental premises underlying U.S. policy. And doing so would actually be a start toward identifying strategic alternatives, different choices that a powerful country ought to be able to make in pursuit of its own interests. So back to those three original questions that I was asked to reflect on. First, what are the implications of relying on a professional military? To phrase it in a, what are the implications of having abandoned the tradition of the citizen soldier, which was the basis of the American military system going back to the founding of this republic? We abandoned that tradition in the wake of the Vietnam War. Well, I think the most obvious, the most important implication is quite obvious. And that is that we have allowed a gap to develop between the military and society. You know the figures. In a country that does seem to be perpetually at war, 1% of our fellow citizens bear the burden of service and sacrifice, while the remaining 99% of us are essentially spectators. This distribution of effort cannot be said to be democratic. And quite frankly, I don't believe it can be said to be moral. But again, the pragmatic question is the one that really counts. Does it work? Does the all-volunteer force work? Does relying on a professional military give us the results we want? Does our military win? That is, does it achieve conclusive success accomplishing our stated political objectives? That's what war is all about, using force to achieve political purposes. Well, sadly, the answer is no. We did not win, and we did not even end the Iraq War. U.S. troops may have left Iraq, but the Iraq War continues down to the present moment. All you got to do is take a look at the papers. In my judgment, we will not win the war in Afghanistan, and in all probability, when we depart, that war also will not end, despite the fact that those are the two longest wars in all of American history. So although the all-volunteer force may be admirable in many ways, let me state it clearly, it is admirable in many ways. Our soldiers are admirable in many ways. But the fact of the matter is, the all-volunteer force has not proven to be an especially effective instrument of policy. As a country, we know how to start wars. But our military has demonstrated an inability to end wars on our terms. The second of my three questions, does maintaining a global military presence make sense? And the answer, it seems to me, is yes, where that presence is both needed and effective. And no, where it is either not needed or not effective. Let me get specific. Europe. The U.S. military presence in Europe is simply not necessary. It is redundant. Threats to European security are, to put it mildly, modest. The Europeans are able to handle those threats to their security, and they should be allowed to do so. Withdrawing U.S. forces just might encourage European countries to grow up and take responsibility for themselves. In the Islamic world, the U.S. military presence has proven to be counterproductive. It incites antagonism. U.S. military power, it seems to me, is largely irrelevant to the problems besetting the greater Middle East. And to persist in thinking otherwise is to squander American power on a futile undertaking. Lowering our military profile in the greater Middle East is an imperative. To the limited extent that we can influence the course of events in the region, we really ought to examine doing so by using alternative means. And I don't mean drone strikes. The best approach just might be to live up to our ideals and therefore thereby demonstrate that liberal values actually have something to offer to others. Asia might be another story. There, I could be persuaded that the U.S. military presence is in fact stabilizing, or to put it another way, that a precipitous withdrawal of U.S. forces could easily trigger a destabilizing military competition between China, Japan, South Korea, and others. And we don't want that to happen. On the other hand, a strategy that too obviously aims to contain China, as if China were our adversary rather than our banker, could inadvertently produce precisely that competition that we wish to avoid. My point here is, with regard to presence, it's not all or nothing. We should be selective in where we have forces deployed abroad, and we should be somewhat cautious about doing that, but arguably Asia is a place where it makes sense to continue that presence. My third question, what role does the military-industrial complex play in influencing U.S. policy? My answer would be some influence, but not nearly as much as some people assume. The size of the defense budget relative to the federal budget is much smaller today than when it was in 1961, when President Eisenhower coined the phrase military-industrial complex. The importance of defense spending relative to the overall economy is much smaller today than it was back in 1961. Still significant. It's not trivial, but it's not nearly as great. My problem with the discussion of military-industrial complex is that there are some critics of U.S. policy who tend to see the military-industrial complex as kind of an all-purpose boogeyman. Drive a stake through the MIC, they seem to think, and all will be good. And I think that represents a significant oversimplification with regard to the actual underpinnings of American globalism, which are ultimately ideological, almost theological, as well as structural. If you want to drive a stake through something, then go after the concept of American exceptionalism. Go after this claim that we are God's new chosen people. Go after this notion that we are called upon to save the world. Go after this notion that because we are called upon to save the world, we're permitted to exercise prerogatives allowed to no other nation. For example, preventive war. There, in this pernicious notion of our specialness, there may lie the ultimate explanation for our inability to think creatively and realistically when it comes to national security policy. Thank you very much.
Thanks to each of you for your excellent opening, provocative remarks here. Let's move to a couple of questions. First, let me ask about the relationship of the armed forces with American popular culture, the American populace in general. Do you think that most American civilians understand and appreciate what American military personnel do in their jobs? And are there ways in which the relationship between the armed forces and civilian society should be improved? Professor Basich.
Well, I mean, this is basically the topic of the book that I'm going to try to get you to buy when we're all done.
He didn't pay me to ask this question, I promise.
And I believe that there is a growing awareness that there's something not right in the claims made by Americans that we support the troops. That phrase that has become so commonplace, I think, in our discourse, thank you for your service, it's not good enough. It's too easy. It's an example of many of you know of, you didn't know, Dietrich Bonhoeffer, the German martyr and theologian, who in the 30s, after Hitler came to power in Germany, basically led a movement to break away from the Orthodox Protestant Christian establishment, Protestant Christian church in Germany, to found what he called a confessing church. And his critique of the establishment church was that it had allowed itself to be compromised by collaborating with the Nazis while still congratulating themselves for being faithful followers of the gospel of Jesus Christ. And Bonhoeffer said that that was what he called cheap grace. This being too quick to pat yourself on the back when it's utterly undeserved, when in fact you ought to be examining your conscience. And I think this superficial, these superficial expressions of affection for the troops, the Budweiser commercial during the Super Bowl, I think this is an example of cheap grace. That if indeed we support the troops and care about the troops, then that should impose obligations to go well beyond cheering or buying beer. And that to some degree we ought to be examining our consciences about how, in my view at least, we've allowed the troops to be abused and misused, and we ought to feel pretty uncomfortable about that.
Thank you.
Well, I've read Andrew's most recent book. It is a terrific book, so I highly recommend it. My books are far less interesting, so I'm not even going to try to make the case you should buy them. But on this question, I have to say I'm a bit torn, because I one of the most powerful parts of your book is the very beginning, where you talk about a sporting event against the Red Sox game, where you, you know, you talked about what we see at all of our games. You see it every Husker game, every Saturday, the affection for the troops. And on the one hand, that's a good thing, and I think that that's something that obviously it comes out of a legacy in which, a bad legacy of ours, which is where we didn't treat troops the way they should have been treated after they served our country. And it's a reminder to all of us that we should honor those who serve and we should respect the contributions and the sacrifices they and their families have made for you, for us. That's a good thing. But it is not enough. I agree with that. I don't think it's enough just to say, well, I did my obligation, I cheered for some folks who just returned from Afghanistan, some wounded warriors maybe, and I clapped and that's all I need to do, and good on me for giving them a nice good cheer. You got to do more than that. One of the things we've been trying to do as a government, working with the private sector, is to try to find opportunities for those who've come back from service. Just yesterday in the Wall Street Journal, the First Lady, Mrs. Obama, had an op-ed talking about an initiative that she and Dr. Jill Biden, the Vice President's wife, have started through the Joining Forces Initiative to help hire 100,000 veterans from Iraq and Afghanistan with construction companies around the country. And their aspiration is to hire 100,000 in the next 5 years. That's a good thing. That's something we should absolutely support, and I hope that all of our private sector and in all walks of life hire veterans and support them. It's not enough to honor them at games. But that is a good thing, and it's a sign of respect, but it's not enough. It shouldn't be a substitute at all.
Thank you. Okay. So what do you believe is the best solution to the proliferation of Al-Qaeda and Al-Qaeda-associated groups in the Middle East and Northern Africa, if not the use of our military forces? Professor Bacevich?
Well, you know a lot more than I do, but let me be the, I'll lay down the straw man.
Sounds good.
Swat it away.
Okay.
I take seriously what I think are the reports, and that is that Al-Qaeda has been seriously depleted over the course of the past decade plus. Now we've got these franchises, so-called. Now I'd be a little bit reluctant to see them as posing an existential threat to the United States of America. I mean, I think we have a sense of proportion about the extent of the threat, not disregard the threat, but this is not the Soviet Union with ICBMs. But beyond that, I think there are very difficult political and strategic questions that perhaps, because they're so difficult, don't get the kind of attention they deserve. Why do these people hate us and want to kill us? Big question, lots of answers. I think one very important answer to which I subscribe is that there is a broader crisis in the Islamic world, and that the essence of that crisis is finding ways to reconcile religious belief with modernity, something that we in the West did more or less as a result of the Enlightenment, which resulted in, very broadly speaking, the privatization of religion and its exclusion, except for symbolic purposes, from the public sphere. The little I know about Islam suggests that that process of reconciliation is even more difficult, given that religious tradition in comparison to the Christian tradition, which is the predominant one in the West. But at the end of the day, that's where the answer lies. And there I think the question is, well, what can we do to further that process of reconciliation? I think one thing we ought to have learned from the last decade is having a bunch of U.S. troops bumbling around does not help that process. That what it really does is to exacerbates the conflict. And we present ourselves as convenient targets. So strategically, what I'm about to say is, don't ask me how I would implement in specific terms. Strategically, it seems to me, what we have an interest in is getting out of the way while they solve their problem, and in the meantime, trying to protect ourselves from any adverse effects as they have this great intra-civilizational argument, which again, to my mind, means lower our military profile.
Well, that wasn't much of a straw man. I agree with a lot of that. So there you go. I think their underlying issues are economic, they're social, they are religious, they are questions that are extraordinarily difficult for any one country or any combination of countries to try to tackle. I think we are trying to lower our profile. That's one of the rationales of getting out of Iraq, is that we weren't contributing to a positive outcome by staying there. And what's happening, though, in Iraq is quite violent. It's quite ugly. But we're not part of it right now. I think that you're absolutely right. There are many sort of franchises or non-franchises, but they're still terrorist affiliates. A friend of mine calls this is the Burger Queen syndrome. And what that means is, in Cairo, they didn't have Burger Kings, but they had Burger Queens. But if you went into a Burger Queen, you thought you were in a Burger King because it had something that, like the Whopper, but it was not part of the franchise technically, but it looked a lot like it. So what we have popping up in too many parts of the world are terrorist versions of Burger Queens, where they look like Al-Qaeda. They're certainly Islamic terrorists, but they're not necessarily Al-Qaeda, and they are a threat to the United States. They may not be a threat to our homeland, but they could be a threat to an embassy. They could be a threat to an oil facility somewhere. Now, they're not 10 feet tall, and we shouldn't make them 10 feet tall, but nevertheless, they are a concern. And there are expectations that all of you would have, and you should have, that we're doing our most to protect our diplomats and protect our allies against these threats. But using the military instrument alone to try to solve them is not going to get it done. We need to do it in combination with other things. Now, in a lot of places around the world, take Egypt, for example, where we have a very close relationship with them. We have a very close military relationship. We have a very close political relationship. The United States is not occupying Egypt right now. But nevertheless, Egypt is undergoing a dramatic historic transformation. I'm not sure where it's going to end up. But I know we have a huge stake in how it ends up. We have a huge political stake. We have a huge strategic stake. We have a huge security stake. So I wish there were a silver bullet. This has been one of the in terms of dealing with Islamic extremism, this has been one of the efforts that the administration really from day one has tried to tackle. The president, of course, famously went to Cairo in the spring of 2009 and gave a speech about U.S. outreach to the Muslim world. But we have seen, and what we are seeing in that North Africa, throughout the Middle East, is a transformation that is not since the fall of the Ottoman Empire have we seen. And how that's going to play out is still yet to be seen, but we have a huge stake in how it plays out.
Well, as we get to the end of the evening here, perhaps we could just offer one last opportunity for a brief minute or two of reflection from either or both of you, if you have things that have come up or have not come up in the discussion here that you think the audience should take with them this evening as they think about the U.S. military, its current situation, and its future.
First of all, thank all of you for being here. I think this forum is extremely important because it's an opportunity for all of you to be engaged and to hear from folks you agree with, from you disagree with, folks you may not otherwise have a chance to spend an evening with, and hear about the issues that we as citizens are facing, and to have a voice and to have your opinions heard. Again, I don't expect people to walk out of here having agreed with anything either of us have said, but this is a very important part of citizenship to do this. So first, I want to thank you for coming. Second, in terms of our role in the world, and I think I want to end where I ended my opening remarks, which is, despite the mistakes we've made, despite the fact we don't get it right every time, the United States is a force for good. And Andrew mentioned this phrase, indispensable nation, which is a phrase that's been kicked around a lot over the last 15, 20 years, since President Clinton first used it in 1996. And President Obama uses it. He just used it several weeks ago in the State of the Union. When we use that phrase, it's not that we're the global hegemon. It's not that we believe that our way is the right way. It's that, for better or for worse, whether we like it or not, there are many problems out around the world that are not solved, that cannot be solved without the United States playing a role. Sometimes it's a leadership role. We have to be the ones bearing most of the burden. Sometimes we are in the background, and we're providing a unique capability here and there to help solve a problem. But it's more often than not, all these big problems are not going to be solved without the United States. In my job, when I work constantly with foreign officials coming into my office, I'm traveling overseas meeting with them, I can't think of any meeting that I've been in where people are asking less of us. In every meeting I'm in, they're asking for more. They're asking for more of our involvement. They're asking more of our ideas, more of our time, more meetings, more of our stuff. It's very rare that we're ever in a meeting where someone says, boy, thanks, United States. We'd really like you to just get out of the way and go home and not be involved at all. They're asking more. Now, that's a burden. That's a burden on public officials. That's a burden on all of you as taxpayers. But it's a burden that we carry proudly. It's one that is really, I think, at the root of what our country's all about. And it is a unique country. It's a country that not every country around the world is an inspiration for others. There's a lot of countries around the world that people would want to see a lot less of in their regions or in their issues. So that's something I always try to keep in mind going about doing my job, is we're tackling these really tough problems that don't have easy answers. There are no silver bullets. No matter what you do, you get criticized by somebody in the press or, you know, one of your friends or family at home. But that's why you just try to go about doing your best, trying to make the decisions, calling it straight, and being willing to suffer the consequences if you get it wrong, and we will get it wrong. But I want to thank all of you for coming and stay engaged.
Professor Bass?
I think I used up all my profound thoughts.
All right.
But I'd echo the point. I have to say it's quite heartening that there would be such a large number of you would come out on, where are we, Tuesday? On a Tuesday night in February to discuss these matters. It's a... apparently, democracy is alive and well in Nebraska.
You've been listening to a program from the E.N. Thompson Forum on World Issues on Noon Forum. The E.N. Thompson Forum is co-sponsored by the Cooper Foundation, the LEAD Center, and the University of Nebraska at Lincoln. Today, we have heard the forum's annual Chuck and Linda Wilson dialogue. The guest speakers were Andrew Basevich, Professor of International Relations and History at Boston University, and author of Breach of Trust, How Americans Failed Their Soldiers and Their Country, and Derek Chollet, Assistant Secretary of Defense for International Security Affairs, and Principal Advisor to the Undersecretary of Defense, and Secretary of Defense on International Security Strategy and Policy Issues related to Europe, the Middle East, and Africa. They have addressed the topic, The American Military, War and Peace, Spending and Politics. This program was recorded by Omaha Public Radio on Tuesday evening, February 11, 2014, for broadcast at this time. Special thanks to Katie Cervantes, E.N. Thompson Forum Coordinator, for helping to make the recording and broadcast of this program possible. Complete Noon Forum listings, as well as an archive of over 400 previous broadcasts, are available on our website, kios.org. Now, this is your producer and host, Bob Cote, thanking you for listening.